Hello. Thank you for tuning in. You are listening to ByteRadio.me's Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. For network or show information, visit www.byteradio.me or call 843-808-0777. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show with your host, Robert Sharp. Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Today, my very special guest is Gary Sirek, and we're going to be talking about his new book, The American Dream Revisited, Ordinary People, Extraordinary Results. Gary is the CEO and top producing agent of Sirek Financial Services in Canton, Ohio. It's a financial institution that's been around for about 60 years. It was started by his father, Stan Sirek, who taught Gary the most important lesson of his career. Quote, "My job isn't to make as much money as I can. It's to help the other person in my room accomplish their goals." His most recent book, The American Dream Revisited, Ordinary People, Extraordinary Results, is a deeply personal topic for Gary. The book is a collection of compelling stories from people that overcame a variety of adversities to achieve their American dream. For more information, you can visit his website, which is www.theamericandreamrevisited.com. Again, theamericandreamrevisited.com. And I do have a direct link to that website in the show page description. So with that, I'd like to welcome Gary to the show. Good day, Gary.
Thank you, Robert.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you. I'm happy to have you here. You know, any time that we can make dreams come true or focus on dreaming, you know, is a good day. So I guess the best place to start with, well, what led you to write this book?
Well, it's very interesting. I have a habit. In the mornings, the first thing I do after I get moving is I stop at one of four coffee shops on my way to work, and I always order the same thing. I order a mocha, and I rotate coffee shops because they all make their mochas differently. And this one morning I sat down and had a mocha at a place called Karma Cafe. And there's four of these on my way to work within like 7 minutes. It's kind of amazing. But nonetheless, I live in Canton, Ohio, where the Pro Football Hall of Fame is. So it's kind of a cool place to live. But anyhow, I'm on my way to work, and I stop in. I sit down at a table, and I was thinking about my day, maybe my week, my month, my life. I'm not really sure, Robert, but I was just kind of minding my own business and kind of creating lists and crossing things out when four college students sat down right behind me, and they started a conversation, and the conversation was the American dream. And they were talking about the American dream, and all of a sudden, it became the American disaster. And they were kind of discussing the fact that they all had college loans, and they had college, they had credit card debt, and the job market was tough, and that, you know, they're doing all this work, and they just had such a negative attitude, and how hard it was going to be, and why were they doing this? It was not a really pleasant conversation over here. Which is too bad because I really kind of like the American dream, so I was excited when they brought it up. Not too happy about the American disaster. Well, the young man who hadn't said anything finally chipped in and said, "Wait a minute, I don't agree with you guys. I think, you know, I'm going to get a good job. I've got a good education. I'll pay my bills off, and I'm going to have a good life." And they kind of shut him up in about 30 seconds. They just put him down. He didn't say another word. So I listened to this. And it really bothered me. I walked out of the coffee shop, Robert, and as I tell you, the place was called Karma Cafe. I walked out with some of the worst karma I could ever remember. I just was in a very bad mood. I didn't like what I heard. And it troubled me. Well, about 3 nights later, probably 4 o'clock in the morning, I woke up and said, okay, this isn't good. I'm going to write a book. I'm going to prove those three guys wrong, and I'm going to back up the one young man who started to say something and they wouldn't let him talk. And that really was the motivation behind the book.
Wow. Yeah, that nothing like a good conversation to kind of, you know, get things stimulated. Now, it's interesting, but, you know, before we kind of go into exactly what the American dream is, do you you know, that 3-to-1 negative to positive, you know, ratio, do you think that is representative, you know, maybe even on a more of a national scale, what some of the feeling is?
Well, I don't know, but here's something very ironic. I went to college. I went to Miami of Ohio and Oxford a long time ago, and I took an American literature course, and in that American literature course, it was a survey course, at least I thought it was, but it turned out to really be a course about the American dream. I just didn't know that. But what happened, it was the Vietnam War was going on. There was lots of stuff happening. Women's rights were being debated. It was a lot of turmoil. And in our class, it was clearly 3-to-1, three very negative and one positive. And that's what it was back then. And so sitting at the table was exactly what I had faced when I was in college, and I was one of the positive guys. I mean, I saw we had problems, but I still had a pretty positive outlook on life for the most part. And I realized I was really in the minority, and I'm not sure the answer to your question, but it sure didn't change much from that many years ago to today, at least sitting in that little coffee shop and listening. And I have to say, there's a lot of negative out there. It's much harder to find positive people than it is. You can find negative people all over the place, the paper, news, radio, TV. It's really hard to find positive people, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I think a lot of that is very much just exactly like what happened there, where you had the three negatives calling it out, you know, the positive kind of stepping in, then beaten down into silence in a way. So, I mean, and ultimately the loudest and longest noise were those from the negative perspective.
And I agree with you completely. And that's really what stood out in that conversation. And again, it wasn't that their points weren't valid points. It's just not how you want to start your life, thinking that it's all going downhill.
Yeah. You want to be a little bit optimistic. I mean, because it makes a big difference. So for you, what does the American dream mean to you personally?
Well, it's kind of interesting. I grew up in a family. My father, my grandfather owned a business, and unfortunately, it failed when I was pretty young, and my dad worked in that business. It was in the beer distribution business in Canton, Ohio, and it did well for a while, and then it didn't do well, and eventually it closed, and so my dad lost his job, as did my grandfather. So my grandfather moved in with us, and virtually six people were living in a house built for three, and that wasn't good, and we didn't really have a lot of money. In fact, we had none. And I learned that later in life, but I kind of knew that because there were so many discussions that weren't very positive growing up. There was a lot of turmoil in my house. And I was a little kid, but I was very observant. I guess I've always been observant. And I would just listen to what people said, and I would try and process what it meant. And sometimes I could, sometimes I couldn't. But what I know is that it wasn't easy, so my dad found a job in the life insurance business. And that was a very hard way to make a living, although we've managed to do that now for 60 years. It sure didn't start out well, and he ended up selling shoes on the weekend to supplement so we could eat and stay where we're at and pay the mortgage. And he hated selling shoes, Robert. I mean, absolutely detested it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be my first
time. And I have... Oh, God, no. And I have one very vivid memory of this, which is kind of strange, but, you know, you remember things when you're a kid. Well, I remember my father coming home on Saturdays in a horrible mood, throwing down whatever money he made that day on a table and washing his hands about 12 times and talking how much he hated touching people's feet. And I just have that vivid image of my father doing that. And not in a good mood, by the way. I mean, he just was in such a foul mood doing that, and it was just not a great, you know, just one of those things that happened, and you observe it. So later on in life, my father figured out how the insurance business worked, and actually got some further education in it, and turned out to be a really tremendous producer, and a great advocate of life insurance, why people should own it, and actually became incredibly successful. So we went from being really stone cold broke to all of a sudden having like a different life. It was very strange. So I really, in my own way, without even knowing I was doing this, I kind of grew up in the American dream.
Yeah.
If
so,
that is
I
the
mean,
American dream, it, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, I would think that the American dream just means so many different things. I would think it means different things to different people. And you know, in many cases it seems to be achieving or experiencing some degree of success, whatever you would define as success, you know, in your environment. So, I mean, it would be, to me, it just seems like that's the, would be maybe the underlying idea of the dream, what the individual would.
Completely agree with you, Robert. And in fact, in my father's case, it was food, clothing, and shelter. And that's what happened. He just wanted to make sure he had enough money to provide for his family. And that, to me, was a huge accomplishment because when it changed, it changed. I mean, it wasn't like overnight. All of a sudden, it was like he hit the lotto. But you could just see little signs and things that happened in our lives that just got a little bit better, a little different, a little strange, at least in my mind, strange. And all of a sudden, you know, we had never gone out to dinner. We actually went out to dinner. And I thought, wow, that's really weird. We've never been out to dinner. You know, I actually had, I had like new shoes. I never had new shoes. I mean, it's as strange as that is. That's kind of how it worked. And that's what I grew up in, and it was okay. It was just very, very different. So I think the dream is really different for everyone. And it's funny, though, when I wrote the book, I interviewed 25 people all across the country. And I ended up with 13 chapters. So I wrote 13 stories off of the 25 interviews I did. And one of the things that was prevalent in all 25 interviews was that life was all about food, clothing, and shelter for every single person. Now, there's some other ripples to that, but those were big.
Yeah, the basics for survival, Maslow's, you know, base needs. So now, what would you say that you learned, you know, from gathering these? Now, when you said you interviewed 25 people, how did you cast out the net for those stories?
Well, I started asking pretty much everyone I knew. Once I decided I wanted to do this, I said, okay, I need to meet some new people and find some new stories. I didn't know the people mostly that I interviewed, so I asked people who was the most interesting person they knew and what was their story. And I said, by the way, they have to still be living. So that's what happened. So I would interview people who knew different people, and they'd say, oh, I got this person I know. They live in California. You ought to call them. And I'd say, okay. So I would set up an appointment, call them, and interview them. Excuse me, a doctor in Columbus, a dentist somewhere else. You know, it was just all kinds of different people I interviewed all over the country, all different ethnic backgrounds, different countries they came from. It was kind of fascinating.
Yeah. Well, you know, the one thing I liked about the stories is you guys titled the chapter as a perspective, like the you know, the workman's perspective, the faith perspective. I mean, it really, for I think as far as showing that, you know, perspective really is the key to understanding a lot of this, the idea of striving for that American dream.
And that's really what happened, Robert. When I did this, and I was thinking about all these different perspectives, because they all had a different view. Although, again, they all sort of started with, actually, it was interesting. I interviewed a young man from South Africa, and he really came here because he did not have a chance in the world to vote, and he felt like he was possibly in danger every time he walked the street, and that's because he was. And so he said, you know, I really came here because it was a safer environment. I could own a business and I could vote. And he said, I could never do that in South Africa that I grew up in. So everybody had their own kind of spin on the American dream and what made them come here. And that was really interesting. And then the other side of it, too, is once they got here, what happened to them and how they evolved and the different turns and twists they had in their life. It just made it really interesting to interview all these people and weed them out, by the way, because I really needed to get the book to a point that I wanted it to be lengthwise, and that meant I had to, my editor cut a ton of stories, which I was fine with, so.
Yeah.
He didn't cut mine.
Well,
that was good. So that was.
Yeah. Well, you know, and it to me, it really showed the everyday man, woman, you know, approach to the dream. And you, I think somewhere in the book you describe it as a force. Is that, would you consider that to be like an energy in and of itself, the American dream?
Yes. Yeah, I really do think so. I feel like that. And the people I talked to really felt like that too, because they really took it on as a life purpose, and it's something that really drove them. And again, their individual drivers were perhaps different, but they really were heavily motivated to make this thing really work and to do it. And to do it in this country, and it, you know, some could have left and gone back to their other, you know, their countries, but they chose not to. They looked at this and said, yeah, this is a challenge, this is incredibly hard, but we're going to hang in here and we're going to make this happen.
Yeah. What would you, I mean, obviously you believe in the American dream, and you know, you have plenty of examples cited in the book. So would you say that, where would you say the pulse of, you know, how healthy is that force, you know, in today's America, in your opinion?
Well, it's not talked about very much, and certainly not in the way the politicians talk about it isn't at all the way the people that I interviewed talked about it. I found that fascinating, too, how it's been spun in a different direction. You know, it wasn't about owning your own home, and it just wasn't that. It was just making sure that, you know, there's enough money on the table that you could do the things you need to do and keep your family safe. And that was so strong. I mean, that whole idea of being in a safe environment, as safe as you can be in a country that, you know, anyway.
Yeah.
So it's kind of an anomaly to me how they've twisted the American dream. So my sense is there's a very strong undercurrent of it, but I don't think it's talked about, at least not in the way I've expected it to be talked about positively for some time.
Yeah. You know, I mean, and from the sound of it, you know, that basic, you know, food, clothing, shelter, you know, and some success seems, you know, it seems to be that underlying current. And you know, I think it's a shame when we get to a point when a perversion, you know, the misuse of a positive concept and idea, you know, it gets to the point where, you know, we don't talk about it just because it's been hijacked in a way, you know, as far as trying to promote a particular position. And to me, it's a shame that we've gotten to that point. I think, do you feel that maybe we are, now, I don't want to get political, but with the DACA, you know, the deferred children, you know, they call them the dreamers, you know, and we talk about, you know, an American dream. Do you think, politics aside, that they are like the seeds of what would be, could be the journey of a typical American dream being achieved?
Yes. I really do. I've tried to stay out of the political world as much as humanly possible because I don't find it rewarding, and I just have a hard time understanding how people can tell you one thing and do the exact opposite. It's just hard for me to grasp, but it seems like that's how the game's played. And I say, okay, well, I didn't see that one coming, and now I see all of it coming because I don't believe anything I'm told, and I just say, oh, interesting.
Right.
But that's the way I've had to deal with politics, because
right.
I just, you know, someone said, why don't you run for office? And I said, are you kidding me? I mean, they were serious, and I said, there isn't any way in the world I would ever do that, because I just don't know that I could feel comfortable in that arena. So to answer your question, I think it's fascinating. Of the 25 people I interviewed, I would say probably half of them weren't from this country. And the ones who weren't from this country, And again, I didn't write about all of them in my book because they didn't make the cut, but it was unbelievable. Yeah, they were amazingly successful, incredibly generous. I mean, some of them had taken a lot of their money and put it into foundations to help their own countries back home and their own students and their own children, relatives. I mean, one person in particular started an orphanage because where he came from, there were so many kids abandoned, and he literally set up an orphanage slash school, and he built it, and he houses it, he feeds them, and he pays for the teachers, and I think he pays for their clothing, everything, and he came here with virtually nothing, but he made a lot of money, and he said to me, he said, Gary, I have such a good life, you know, this is just how I choose to spend it. So I think I got a lot of that, a tremendous amount of generosity towards people that were struggling also. And I think, you know, I look at people who come here and they have an ideal of what this country is going to be like. In fact, I'll never forget this. There's a lady from Colombia I interviewed, and she said, you know, I was always told that the streets of America were paved with gold. And I said, seriously? And she said, yeah, when I was a kid, that's what I was told. And I said, what'd you find out? She said, well, she said, if gold is hard work, that's what they're paved with. And
wow.
I said, yeah. She said, this is hard. It's hard to make a living. It's hard to work here. She said, this is a tough country to operate in. And I said, yeah, but are there any easy ones? She said, I don't know. But she said, I can tell you. Now, that being said, she's moved herself up from literally being an hourly worker in a candy store to where she's running a division of a major corporation. So I think she's doing fine. It's just, and she works very, very hard. Yeah, it's kind of fascinating. When I asked her about it, I said, so, you know, I know what her title is, and she's VP of something in human relations or whatever. And, yeah, so I know that there's a path here.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, that's, and I think that's the, that's the important message that really needs to get out to the young adults like those that you overheard, you know, in the cafe shop, coffee shop. You know, those are the kinds of things that one person who was, you know, tried to get his voice heard, you know, was trying to say, to get that definitely more out there. So do you find... or do you find yourself, now that you've done the book, kind of sensitive to American dream stories?
Oh, yeah. And defending what I wrote about. Oh, I've had some people really call me on the carpet. And I've done a lot of speaking engagements, Robert. So I've done, you know, up close with 50 people. I've had a 301. I've had some pretty interesting groups I've chatted with. And I've had some people really go after me on this. And, well, you don't know what you're talking about. You don't understand how hard it is today. And I say, wait a minute, time out. I said, I'm in the room. I'm still here. I'm living. I interviewed all these people. You didn't interview any of them. And you're criticizing something that you don't really have personal experience with. Well, I have this and that. And I said, yeah, but you're looking at it in your vacuum, and you're not looking at it in the vacuum of the country or the way the world works. And I said, I beg to differ. So, yeah, I've had some people confront me, and then I've had people come up to me and say, oh, my God, that was so inspirational, Gary. It just changed my life, and which is kind of strange, too. I didn't really write it to change people's lives. I just wrote it because I was really ticked. So.
Whatever the motivation, you know, getting those positive results is good. We're about halfway through the show, so I want to take just a quick break, and I do want to invite listeners, if you would like to call in, you can dial 619-789-4359. And for those listening live in the chat room, you know, feel free to type in your questions there. And then when we come back from the break, Gary, in your the final book of final chapter of your book called My Perspective, you offer seven different key skills that you feel will help people along their journey to achieving their American dream. So when we come back, I'd like to talk about maybe a couple of those that you feel are extremely important.
Absolutely.
Okay, great. Everyone stay tuned. We'll be right back after this brief break.
Hello, this is Robert Sharp. I want to thank you for joining us and hope you are enjoying today's show. Just a reminder that we have a wealth of information and resources available on our website, www.biteradio.me. There is a calendar of upcoming shows, along with an archive link that will give you access to more than 1,200 shows we have had over the past 7 years. Also on the site are links to the products and services we provide, books, greeting cards, photography, and a wellness store. Our show is available as a free podcast on iTunes, and you can subscribe for free at the iTunes Store, or even quicker, there is a link on our website homepage. We are also on many social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, etc., and we also have buttons to those platforms on the top of our homepage. Our website, www.biteradio.me, has much for you to explore and enjoy. I also very much appreciate you supporting our guests, and especially today's guest. And now, back to the show.
Okay, everyone, thank you for staying with us. Again, today my very special guest is Gary Sirak. We're talking about his new book, The American Dream Revisited, Ordinary People, Extraordinary Results. And again, you can find out more by visiting the website, www.theamericandreamrevisited.com. And again, there is a direct link to that website in the show page description. And definitely pick up the book. There's really great stories that'll really inspire you. So with that, we're back, Gary.
Thank you.
Okay.
So, Robert, it's interesting. Yes. When we're talking and I was thinking about some stuff and I said, huh, and you asked me what would be good things to discuss, well, I came up with another one too. So we're good here.
<All right. laughs> Okay, great. Yep. And I had one that I didn't even tell you.
So we had a curveball at me. All right, we're good.
There you go.
Okay,
no,
fire
no,
away.
No. So, okay, well, you know, you listed seven different aspects or skills that people that are important for people to utilize to make their journey toward the American dream, you know, more a reality. So let's talk about a couple of those. What would you say is one of the most important of those seven skills?
Probably number one would be just an absolute failure to quit. I mean, they would have all kinds of stuff happen to them, all kinds of adversity, tragedies in some kind of, just devastating information or devastating results. And all of a sudden, you know, they're looking saying, should I keep going? And what I found is all of these people were able to get back off the mat and keep going. And that was just a huge asset. And again, they all told me the same thing. You know, we all wanted to quit, and they really did. And they didn't. And the fact that they didn't quit is what allowed them to get to success. And sometimes it took them 3 years, sometimes 5 years, 7 years. One guy took 9 years. I mean, for 9 years, he struggled. And then when he turned the corner, it was a big corner. So he just sit there and you say, okay,
yeah,
that was cool. So
yeah.
I think
well, then,
that's
you know,
a big one.
Yeah, it is, you know, because the one thing, I have found, you know, several people have come to me over the years, you know, with their ideas and what they're going to do. And I, first of all, I'm amazed at how many people don't even get to the next step of starting what it is they want to do. There's just so many, I should write a book, I should do this, I should do that. But actually taking action toward that goal, I'm surprised, you know, at the ratio of people who don't do that. And then not only starting it, but also, like you say, you know, having the perseverance, you know, to continue, even though it might be frustrating.
Totally. And you're right. I can't tell you, as a financial advisor, I have tons of people come and see me and they say, oh, I should have started this earlier. I mean, they're 60 and they're just starting to think about retirement. I'm saying, really? That's not going to work. And they knew they had to do something. They just refused to do it. And in their case, they failed to start, which isn't good. But you know, to get anywhere, you got to start. And I can't believe how many people come across my desk and how many people I come across in the real world, and they just can't get started. And they don't even give it a chance. So they'll never know if the idea they had was a good one or a bad one because they just never got to the beginning of it. So you can't start a race unless you actually start it.
That's right, exactly. So, okay, so the failure to quit would be
number
one of those
one.
Skills. What would be another one?
Humor. All of the people I interviewed all had a sense of humor, but not a sense of humor that you would expect, not, you know, people telling jokes or things like that. They all had a sense of humor about themselves. They could laugh at their mistakes, their screw-ups, the things they didn't know, you know, stupid things they did, and they were, every single one just really could laugh at themselves. And I found that fascinating because there's a lot of people who would never laugh at themselves. That would just be completely, they think they're whatever they are, and they would never consider the fact that, you know, they would be humorous or they did something incredibly stupid. But these people all found that really, they all told me the stories. You know, I said, well, what was one of the dumbest thing you ever did? Oh, you're kidding, Gary, this was so stupid. I can't believe I did this. And one guy said, you know, it was so ridiculous. He said, I'm looking at this invention I'm working on, and what was I missing? I said, yeah. He said, well, I was missing a plastic plug. And he said, I showed it to a friend of mine. He says, why don't you just put a plastic plug on? He said, oh, my God, I never thought of that. You know, and it was just was funny. And he said, Gary, he said, I tried all these other plugs. They wouldn't work. I put the plastic one. It worked perfectly. And he said, you know, Gary, it was just unbelievable. He said, and I had all these, you know, ideas, and they were so complex. And this guy said, yeah, just plug it. And okay. So, you know, things like that. But what was interesting to me, too, is they could find humor in the direst of circumstances. And that was something else that I thought was interesting. That it wasn't all fun and games, believe me, because failures and laughing at your failure and saying, okay, that was really bad. What do I do next? You know, that, I think that's a wonderful trait.
It is. It is. And sometimes that laughter has to come a little bit. Some time has to elapse in order to move from the, oh, my God, what did I do, to the, ha-ha, what did I do, you know.
Been there many times. Yeah, it's not one of those things where I screwed something up and said, oh, that was great. You know, I smacked into a telephone pole. Well, that wasn't so good. I didn't think that was particularly funny. But when I tell the story today, it's a little funnier. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, in humor, humor is just really important. It's just the whole, it creates a disposition, you know, to allowing things to happen without, I mean, because when you talk about getting back up after being knocked down, I mean, you know, it takes a little bit of effort. But if you can laugh a little bit about how you got down, I tripped over that one step I did not see, you know, and you know, then it's not as bad, and it's easier to get up and move forward.
And that really was the point, and all of them had that trait, and it was just fascinating hearing them talk about it, because I asked them the same questions for the most part, and when they gave me that one, they all just had the same answer, so that was fun. The other one, Robert, that really struck me, and there's two really, but mentorship. All of them had mentors, and sometimes they had many mentors, but every single person I talked to had someone in a higher place that they could go to and fall back on, and someone that was a person that they trusted, that didn't have a vested interest, that just was trying to help out. Single person. And I thought that was very cool.
And you said some of them had multiple. So was it a case when they may have had a particular mentor for a particular period, you know, and then as their life shifted, the mentors shifted? Or
yes, that is really exactly. In some cases the mentors were lifelong, but in many cases they were the person that got them started. And in some cases they got them started and never ended up talking again to them. I mean, it's funny, I was in a coffee shop today, shocking, I know that would be, but I was talking to a friend of mine who's starting a business, and we were talking about it's a food tour, and she's got this really cool idea. So we had this conversation, and one of the things we talked about was mentors, because it's so important to find someone who knows what to do that you don't know, that you can ask someone in a higher authority that they've been there and done it. And I think, so what I've found is in my life and my financial career, I've had a number of different people that I have fallen back on and said, hey, I'm really struggling with this. How do you do this? And they're very willing to help.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and that's the one thing that I found is that people are very willing. You know, you just have to ask. Because, then, you know, it shows that their time here and their experience is needed, that it's important and it's sought after, and that's a very affirming kind of interaction to have.
And I think so, too. And they are flattered. By the way, I flattered some people. I said, well, listen, I'm really struggling with this problem. What do you think? And they look and said, wow, you're asking me. I said, well, you know how to do this? They said, yeah. I said, well, that's why I'm asking you. So, but they really are flattered, and it helps them. It gives them a sense of appreciation and gratitude in my part, so.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, so mentorship, humor, and failure to quit. Is there any others that you want to highlight?
Excuse me. Generosity. I love that one. Mm-hmm. Because mm-hmm. all of these people started with nothing. And all of them, every single one of them, is incredibly generous. Now, they may not be generous as much with money because they may not have so much. And that's the other thing. People think, you know, and I like watching Shark Tank and all that stuff, but it isn't about getting rich. Yeah, it's really a fun show to watch, and I find it interesting how they compete. And the people who come on, and some of their ideas are great, and some of them I look and say, really, what planet are you on? But nonetheless, there's the idea that these people are just incredibly generous. So it might be their time, it might be what they know, their knowledge, they volunteer here, they volunteer there, or they send money over. And it's just interesting how every single one of them had a generous side to them. And it wasn't about hoarding dollars. It wasn't that at all.
Yeah, it's much more. It's just that whole journey of creation and getting something out there and, you know, making a difference to whomever, you know, receives it. You know, the one thing that I thought was interesting when I was reading the book and your story, because you have your story in there, was that, you know, when it came time to the giving back, that it was at your dinner table with your parents when you folks made the shift from you know, trying to make ends wave at each other to actually being able to, you know, talk about, you know, charity and volunteerism and that kind of thing. So anyway, I thought it was interesting because this was at the dinner table. This is something. This was a concept that just was new to you. And I'm just wondering how many, you know, parents really teach their children, you know, that particular concept.
I don't know the answer to that, but I have a feeling not very many. I mean, one of the problems is I don't know if families eat dinner together much anymore. I'm really wondering how that works because schedules are so crazy and we got soccer practice and basketball practice and, you know, whatever, ballet, and kids are running everywhere and theater, and I just think that parents are moving so fast and kids are moving so fast that sitting down and having a meal and having a discussion probably doesn't happen as often as it did when I was a kid. I'm sure it doesn't. I mean, our dinner was you were at home at 5:30, and if you were there at 5:45, you didn't eat. So you walked in.
Right.
If you're there at 5:36, you didn't eat. It was 5:30, and that's how the game was played, and you didn't go late because that's how we played. So everybody sat at the table, and that's how it was. So growing up, I heard many discussions when they didn't have money and they were really stuck. And then I heard discussions when they had money and what they were going to do with it. So I'm not real sure, but I did something in my company that was kind of cool about probably 7-8 years ago. And I started a program called Angels on the Street in my financial services company. And it was really based on giving. And what I would do, there's a man in Canton, Ohio, who anonymously donated money to people during the Depression and wrote them checks. And the checks were for, I think, $5 or $10 back in, you know, Depression. That's a lot of money. and it was amazing how much you could buy for $5. But these people would write a letter to this anonymous website in Canton, Ohio, and if this gentleman decided he liked their story, he would send them a check. So for my whole life growing up, no one knew who that man was. And he went by the name B.VIRDOT. No clue who this guy was. And it was always a Christmas story. Around Christmas, this guy had done that, and so it would come out every year in our paper. A few years ago, someone discovered it was his grandfather, and he wrote a book about it, and the book's called A Secret Gift. So I really like the story, what happened and how it started and what it was all about. So I'm having lunch with a friend of mine, and I said, you know what, we should do something with this. And he said, what? I said, well, why don't we give our employees, and in my case, I gave them each $100. And I said, here's what I want you to do. I want you to go out, and I want you to find someone worse off than you. I want you to give them the money, and then I want you to come back and tell everybody who you gave it to, why you gave it to them, and what happened. And I tell people I made 3 mistakes. Number one, when I brought them all back in, I didn't film it. Number two, I did not have enough Kleenex. Big mistake. Robert, that was a really bad one. And number three, I didn't understand what it would do for teamwork. But it really changed. I mean, my company just became so much closer when we did this and we told the stories. So I ran that for a few years, and then I mixed it up completely, and I said, okay, instead of you getting to decide who to give the $100 to on the street, your kids get to make that decision. And so every one of my employees had a discussion with their children about charity and how charity works and who to give it to. And one wanted to give it to his grandmother because she always bought him ice cream. And he said, no, that doesn't really work. But it was just a real education about, you know, how to get your kid thinking about charity. So, and the parents would throw in an extra $100 of theirs. And so the kids could each give away, you know, 4 kids, they could 50 apiece. And they would drive around trying to figure out who to give them the money to and why and have these really cool discussions.
Wow, that's great. Those are both very creative programs. And, you know, that side benefit of having the teamwork, I mean, I can see where it would bring people together. And so often, you know, that can be a real challenging thing to do. But this one is, you know, not only charity, but, I mean, there's so many components to that. I'm surprised that you didn't have one filmed, you know, after the first the first time out.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I should have. And there is some on the internet. I have some other people who have done it, and actually it spread pretty well. In the first year, we gave away between myself and my friend and some other companies who found out about it, probably $25,000. And last year, it was well over $100,000, and it spread around the country. I know there's different people around the country doing this because of what we started, which, and again, I don't, you know, I'm not trying to make anything more out of it than it is, but it's very cool, it's fun, and it's one of those things. It's like one friend of mine said, hey, I can't afford $100. I said, okay, give him 50. So he gave him 50.
Right.
And in fact, one of his people went to McDonald's and bought $5 $10 gift certificates, gift cards. And then he went out on the street, and he found 5 people that looked like they could really use $10 at McDonald's.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave those cards away. And his story of the 5 people he chose and what happened was, he said it was just remarkable. So it's just the small things, and that's not a big one, but it sure has power.
Yeah,
so generosity was big. we got off track, Robert, but it's generosity. I just think those people were incredibly generous, and it was very cool.
Yeah, very much so, and that's a great one as far as giving back. Now, one of the things too, I believe one of the skills you talk about there is that successful entrepreneurs have the ability to remember where they came from, both literally and figuratively. To me, you know, if you're talking the American dream, it always has to have that beginning point, you know, of what things were like. Then the dream happens, and this is what the result is. So it seems that's a really important thing, to kind of be humble in a way and keeping in mind where you came from.
I agree, and all my interviews agree too, because what I realized, and my father was a great example of this, my father never forgot where he was at and who helped him in life. And he would constantly look back at where we were, and he'd look at the future and smile and see what's there, but he really always had a tendency to look back and say, boy, this is where we were. Look where we are now. He said, I keep wanting to pinch myself and see if this is real. And actually, that's the same thing with the people I interviewed. They all have that same feeling, and they just never envisioned they would be where they are today. And looking back really helped them to process what had accomplished. And it also kept them from feeling bad about not accomplishing something in the future, because by grading yourself backward to the present, you just look and say, wow, this is really amazing. I'm where I am today. And yeah. I found that to be very energizing.
It would be. Now, one of the things that I was surprised to is one of the areas you talk about is not being afraid to follow your intuition. Now, my followers, we talk about intuition a lot. But, you know, you don't normally hear someone from, you know, a larger organization be talking about, you know, the importance of following your, not being afraid to follow your intuition. So is that just...
Yeah.
Good business.
I'm pretty comfortable with that.
A new facet of business.
It's one of those things, Robert, I'm pretty comfortable with it, but, you know, it's kind of, and I don't want people to think it's woo-woo because it's not, but sometimes you just get a feeling, say, wow, this is the right person. So I give you a great example. We were looking to hire, and we had 70 resumes in. And I looked at the resumes, and literally I was able to pick up the resume, read what was on it, and know right away that they weren't a good fit. And just by how they put things together, how they expressed themselves, I knew that these just weren't the people I was going to hire. And out of 70, I got 4. Well, one of them I read, and I kept reading it over and over and over again, and I said, you know, there's just something about the way this person expresses themselves that I find very interesting and engaging. So we interviewed the 4 people. And the person I hired was that person. And my intuition was that's who I was going to hire. I said, I'm open-minded. The other three people is great. But that one just really resonated. And I've had situations like that all the time. And the key, though, is most times people I know have a tendency to outvote their gut. So if their gut says, oh, you got to do this, now I'm going to do it this way. And when I talked to the people I interviewed, I asked them about gut wisdom. I said, okay, tell me about your intuition. Oh, I don't have any. I said, really? And they said, well, what made you build that plan? I said, well, I thought it might be a good idea. Okay, that's intuition. I'd say to someone, yeah, why did you do this? And I said, well, you know, I don't know. It was just lucky. And I said, okay. So people call intuition anything from luck to, you know, blind squirrel finding an acorn. I mean, everything you can imagine I heard. But when they really drill it down, it's intuition.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, yeah, and you know, some of my listeners would probably register on the woo-woo scale, but I'm sure.
I get that all the time. I mean, I don't. Yeah. I don't. That's why I didn't call the book woo-woo.
I know, the American Dream woo-woo. It's actually a perfect title. So yeah, and it's just one of those things where, again, when it comes to being successful, you know, at what you're doing, it just seems so important to, you know, hone in on what it is that, you know, you're passionate about, keep working, and follow your intuition, you know, kind of not disregard that guidance.
Well, and I agree completely. In fact, a person I had lunch with yesterday was telling me a story, and I asked him at the end of the story, and because it could have gone either way, and I said, well, let me ask you a question. I said, what's your intuition say you should do here? What's your gut telling you to do? And he looked at me and said, well, my advisors are telling me to do this. I said, I didn't ask you that. I said, what's your gut say? He said, the exact opposite. I said, what are you going to do? And he said, well, after talking to you, I'm going to do the exact opposite. I said, why? He said, because the more I think about this, they don't really understand it. And here I am letting them tell me what to do. And no offense to, you know, what their positions are, but they don't really get this. And the truth of the matter is I think it's a pretty good idea. I'm going to go with it. I said, okay. I mean, I tried to stay out of it. I didn't, you know, I don't have a vote.
Right.
But I had the ability to question him. And as soon as I questioned him and asked him what his gut would do and what he's feeling, because he was going to go the exact opposite of what he really wanted to do, at least internally.
Right.
And I frankly think it'll probably work what he's trying to do.
Yeah, well and that's good. And you know, no matter what people call it, it's, you know, again, you know, that your, I think your body gives you that guidance, you know, as to what, you know, what is good for you, and what things, you know, to avoid. I follow it a lot. So,
yeah.
One last aspect. I understand that there is in the Dream, American Dream Revisited scholarship.
Yes. So, flashback to my Karma Cafe. I walk into Karma Cafe where I wrote the idea for the book and those college kids, and I was sitting there one morning again sipping my mocha and just thinking, and all of a sudden it dawned on me that I really liked that one young man who didn't get to say anything, and I decided I was going to put a scholarship together, and I really thought of that young man. And the funny thing is I didn't even see these people. I never looked to see what they looked like, who they were. I didn't care. I just wanted to hear what they had to say, and then I really didn't care when they were talking negative about it. But I ended up writing into my book that I would take 20% of the proceeds of every book sold and fund the American Dream Revisited Scholarship, which is actually on my website, and they can get to it there. And we gave our first scholarship away this year, which was very cool. I got a really nice letter from somebody who I have no idea who they were, but we set it up with an institution that would manage the scholarships and manage the money. And I turned it over to them, and we raised enough cash in the first year of selling books. And we're going to do that again this year. We have enough that has come in that I certainly will fund. And it's actually fairly well funded already just by sales. It's been cool. And I've given, again, the first one away. The second one's scheduled to go away in 18.
Wow. Excellent. Excellent. Glad to hear that. You know, that's so nice. And that's in, so in keeping with that giving aspect. So, you know, it seems to me that coffee shops are incubators for you that to go there. And
yeah. Plus, I really like what they serve. So, yeah, especially if they have good dark chocolate, I'm good. So, yeah.
There you go. Well, and I can see why you want to go back. Boy, it's inspirational to go to those. So, I guess, you know, in closing, what do you hope that the book, The American Dream Revisited, will do for people?
I just wanted them to know it's possible, and I just didn't want them to close the door before they even got to open and peek behind it. I want them to know that whatever they're thinking about, dreaming about, it's possible. You know, this is a land of opportunity, and we have tons of opportunities, and that's what really bothered me about the three students is they were not looking at the opportunities. They were just looking at negative stuff, and we are blessed with opportunities. I mean, is it easy? Of course not. It's really, really, really hard. It's like that lady said, you know, it's not paved with gold. It's paved with hard work, and I said, yeah, it is, and I'm not going to deny that, but we have opportunities, Robert, and that's what I wanted to write about.
Yeah, you know, that was the one thing, too, when I was reading your book, you talked about, you know, exploring opportunities and possibilities, and, you know, I just, you know, when I started the show, that was kind of my goal, just open it up, see what happens, and explore. I mean, to me, that's part of the fun of life, is exploring different options and possibilities and seeing what works and what, you know, maybe what doesn't work.
Totally. And that's why I really wrote that book. And when it really came down to it and I was finished thinking about it and where I was at and how I had accomplished what my goal was, which is to write something that hopefully would motivate people, I just felt really proud that I was able to do that. And then what really made me feel better is that I was actually in I was at a conference, and somebody came up to me and said, I have to tell you something. I said, okay. I didn't know who this person was, but I knew who I was because I had a speaking engagement. And I said, okay. And I'm thinking, okay, this could go really one of two ways. And he said, you saved me a tremendous amount of money. And I said, I saved you money? And he said, well, let me explain it differently. He said, you actually made me a lot of money. I said, okay. I saved you money. I made you money. I said, what did I do? And they said, well, I read your book, and I was in the process of trying to decide if I wanted to keep a division of my company open that I had put like 12 years in and never made a dime. And after reading your book, it inspired me so much that I decided to maintain this division and keep it open and not give up. I said, well, that's great. What happened? He said, well, about a year later or 6 months later, somebody contacted me, and he said, it's now producing over $3 million a year in revenue.
Wow.
I said, okay. And I said, that wasn't bad for $15. I said, you paid how much for the book? He said, $15. I said, well, that's a good trade. He said, it's amazing. He said, I'm getting my money back. He said, we signed a long-term contract. It'll generate $3 million of revenue for me over a number of years. He said, and literally, he said, I've invested $3 million in this process, and I thought I was going to walk away and get nothing. I thought that was a cool story.
It is a cool story, you know, and then recognizing the ripple effect, you know, that his decision had on all of the people, you know, that worked for him. I mean, you know, that one decision had an impact on so many other people. So it's you know, the effect of the book can just multiply exponentially, you know, depending on who takes action and follows it.
I agree completely, and it was just really cool. And again, so that was one of those days where I walked down and said, "Whoa, that was good." And you know, it just makes you feel like all that work you did to put this book together was worthwhile. And just one comment like that changes everything. So
it does. It does.
Good stuff.
I agree. Absolutely. Well, Gary, I really wanted to thank you for your time today. I've thoroughly enjoyed speaking with you.
Thank you. Appreciate it. And this is wonderful being interviewed by you, Robin. You did a great job, and you read the book, which is cool, too. So sometimes they don't read the book. It's a little harder.
No. Yeah. And it's such an easy read. So,
thank you. Appreciate that. So.
You're very welcome. Again, everyone, today my very special guest has been Gary Sirek. We've been talking about his new book, The American Dream Revisited, Ordinary People, Extraordinary Results. Again, you can find out more by visiting the website, www.theamericandreamrevisited.com. And again, there is a direct link to that website in the show page description. So everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And until we meet again.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Be sure to visit our website at www.biteradio.me, that's biteradio.me. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Byte Radio Me, and our shows are also available as a free podcast from iTunes. And until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.